What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to episode 139 of Star Wars Beneath Twin Suns, a massive breakdown podcast. We are coming to you today on a fantastic Sunday morning. Really excited to talk about episode 4 of Skeleton Crew. I can't remember. This is a pretty fun episode. I enjoyed it. Watched it a couple of times already. Started watching it a third time. Just ran out of time because I had to go grab some coffee and a bagel before we started recording. But Skeleton Crew continues to impress me. And so, like I said, we're really excited to talk about it. But let's go ahead and get the introductions out of the way. As always, I'm your host, Mercules, joined today by Kit Kutcher. How are you doing this morning, Kit?
Oh, I'm doing pretty fantastic. I am also very excited to talk about remembering or not remembering AT-ATTEN. Because I really enjoyed this episode. I thought it was a ton of fun. I'm actually looking forward to rewatching it again after we finish recording here. So gonna be a nice good Star Wars day for me. How you been, man?
Oh, not too bad at all. I want to give a shout out to Flash in the Discord, who correctly called back in episode 2, I believe, SM33 saying "can't say I remember no AT-ATTEN" was literally him saying "can't say I remember AT-ATTEN," as opposed to him actually, you know, never having heard of it before. So they made it very, very clear in this episode, even before that, you know, that reveal. I think they made it pretty clear that that's where they were driving, but he caught that pretty early. I was impressed by that because as soon as he said it, I was like, oh man, that kind of does make sense. I hadn't thought about that. So I want to give him a shout out for actually being right on that 2 episodes early.
Yeah, that was a very good call out. Excellent foreshadowing in the series as well. Big props to the writers for making that just visible enough that some people were able to pick up on it, and not so obvious that it felt like we were getting beat over the head with foreshadowing. So that's a subtlety, as we've talked about so many times, is a tough thing to do well in Star Wars. And I think that this was just the right amount of subtle, but not too subtle. And it really paid off here in episode 4. And that's the other thing I am appreciating about the writing on this show, is the way that they are sort of setting things up and then paying them off, and not sort of stringing us along or leaving us wondering for the whole series, the way that they've done with some other things in some other shows. I think there have been a lot of lessons learned, and man, Skeleton Crew is reaping the benefits of all of them so far.
What's been so interesting to me is that the writing in the show is very, very good. Like, very, very good. And they're handling the mystery very well, where they are, like, overlapping these mysteries where, like, the characters solve what they thought was the mystery, and it opens the door to another mystery, mm-hmm. right? Like, they met Kim, they got what they thought were the, was the location of AT-ATTEN. They get there, so that mystery is solved and closed, but it turns out it's not AT-ATTEN, right? It's AT-ACKRON, and, you know, it opens up another mystery. And, like, I really enjoy the way they're overlapping these things, and I think the writing is phenomenal. I want to say that, like, in all honesty, this is probably the second best written, you know, live action show we've had behind Andor. And it's amazing that the writing can be so good and yet so different from Andor, right? Andor is not what I would call a kid's show, pretty much at all. It is like a spy drama in the Star Wars universe. It's very adult. Skeleton Crew is like the polar opposite of that. You know, even my wife, who was watching it with me this time, and we'll talk about when we talk about the episode, but I felt like this was the most like childish of the episodes, and that's not a bad thing at all. I just felt like that's what it was. Like, this was the most clearly angled at children that I think out of the 4 episodes we've had so far. And my wife pointed that out, but she was like, but I'm still enjoying it. And I was like, that's a really, really tough line. Like, subtlety is a tough line to do, mm-hmm. but writing something that is very clearly for children that adults can enjoy has been one of the strengths of the Star Wars universe for a long time. And I think some of the bigger failures that they've had recently, and I wouldn't necessarily call them failures, but I think, you know, fans have reacted negatively when something is written for children, but it's written in such a way that it makes it hard for adults to enjoy, right? Like, it's either so ridiculous or so childlike or something. Like, you know, Book of Boba Fett suffered that way in a couple of episodes. I think Obi-Wan Kenobi suffered that way in a couple of episodes. Andor got around that by just writing something that very clearly was not for children.
Right.
Right. So it was like, well, don't have to worry about writing for children and making adults enjoy it if you don't write it for children at all. But that's why Rogue One and Andor are so different from everything else in Star Wars. They're really two of the only things that I think have fully said, look, man, kids can enjoy this, but we're not writing it for kids. We're writing it for adults, and some mature kids may really enjoy this. But like, that's the direction this is taking. This is Band of Brothers in space. This is spycraft in space. That's what it is. Whereas, you know, Book of Boba Fett was described by Robert Rodriguez as, oh, this is like playing with action figures in your backyard, you know, and that's exactly what it was. And it was reminiscent of the Power Rangers stuff from the early 90s.
Yep.
And I don't think kids had a problem with it, but boy, did some adults have issues with it. And every single time we come back to the refrain, like the only time Star Wars is truly a failure is if no, like kids can't enjoy it, right? If kids can't enjoy it at all, then that would be construed as a failure from George Lucas's perspective. But just because adults don't like something that happened in Book of Boba Fett doesn't mean it's a failure. However, adults are the ones who write the checks.
Yeah.
You know? So like the key to success, in my opinion, is kids enjoy it, adults can enjoy it alongside them. And I think Skeleton Crew is doing that at such a high level right now. I say that not having any kids myself.
Right.
But based on the reactions that I'm seeing and based on other people that I'm talking to who are watching the show with their families and stuff like that, and, you know, based on your reaction and your daughter's reaction, like, I think it's doing a pretty good job of that.
Yeah, I have to say it really is, I think, knocking it out of the park so far. And it makes me nervous to say that because, you know, we've kind of had a run of Star Wars shows that have been real hit and miss, even like within the series themselves. And so far for me, Skeleton Crew has by and large been a hit every single week. Maybe every episode isn't perfect, but that's sort of an unrealistic bar to be setting. Every episode is pretty good, and that's a heck of a bar for any TV show to hit. Anyways, do we have some housekeeping to take care of?
We do have a little bit of housekeeping for what feels like the first time in a while. We have some new podcast reviews to read out. So, well, we got three of them from Apple Podcast. And I would like to thank the first person is DBA, who says, nice Star Wars pod, 5 stars. It's a good current Star Wars podcast to listen to, discussing the Star Wars series as they release it. Simple, short, sweet, to the point. Thank you very much, DBA.
Yeah, love it. Thank you.
Next one is from John Podcast Listener. He says, the best Star Wars podcast, 5 stars. If it wasn't for these two and their extensive knowledge of Star Wars and coverage, I wouldn't know what was happening in those galaxies far, far away. Keep it up, please. So thank you again to John Podcast Listener.
All right. We will.
And last one is from fan of the podcast, Dirt, who is a common fixture in the Discord. He says, real fans, 5 stars. This is a podcast from people who actually enjoy Star Wars. And it's for people who actually enjoy Star Wars. So another great review. And that is kind of the motto of the show that we have tried to live by, right? This is a show for people, or by people who enjoy Star Wars, for people who enjoy Star Wars.
Yeah, I think that's maybe, could it put it more succinctly if we tried? So thank you.
Mm-hmm. So again, I would like to, we don't have any new patrons this month, but again, I'd like to just always give a little call to action that the best way to support the podcast outside of just listening to it, which is super important to us, is to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast or on Spotify. And if you'd like to, you can join the patron and get access to the Senate, which is the patrons only channel in our Discord. You do not have to join the patron to join the Discord. You're welcome to just join the Discord and hang out and chat. But the Senate is where we offer exclusive like previews of the episodes before we edit them and post them. A lot of times we talk about what we discussed, and it's where we have a lot of good back and forth. You know, we share links discussing Star Wars content, not just Skeleton Crew, but kind of everything. It's just in general a fun place to be. So if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk more Star Wars, because neither of us are super active on like public social media at this point in time anymore, the Discord is the best place to catch us.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Very much so for me. I'm actually like almost entirely not on social media days outside of Discord, because that's just the place that still brings me joy to interact. So that's where I want to be.
Absolutely. And don't let the name of the Discord, the Imperial Security Bureau, fool you. It is still a lighthearted, fun place to be.
Yeah. As is the actual Imperial Security Bureau, I'm sure.
Yeah. They all, you know, they have office, was it life day parties and stuff like that? So
Why they have Empire Day parties, you know.
Empire Day, there you go. Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, I guess let's go ahead and get started with episode 4. Again, it is called Can't Say I Remember No At Atten. This one was directed, I believe, by the Daniels are the ones who directed this episode. So Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert. I might be pronouncing their name wrong. If Daniel S., if you are listening to this podcast, feel free to write in and correct me on the thing. But
I think
this was an interesting one. So I personally, as an adult, really enjoyed the beginning and end of this episode. I found the middle part to be just like kind of a disconcerting subject matter, but handled like very, very, I would say lighthearted is not the right word. They don't make a joke of it, right? You pointed out that they do correctly insinuate that like, hey, this is wrong. You guys shouldn't be doing this. But they handled it in what I felt was like a way very much designed to just like allow children to like enjoy it. And it threw me off just a tiny bit.
They gave it, I would say, the mouse gloves treatment. So without necessarily changing what the sort of the reality of the situation is, they kind of were like, we're just going to handle this very gently and not go too deep into the reality of the situation. We're going to acknowledge it. And we're going to move on with the story that we're looking to tell here today.
Yeah. And,
you know, I think given that this is a kid's show, that's sort of what needed to happen. Very, you know, whether or not they needed to go there at all, I guess, is a whole other question. But that is where they went.
Yeah, I think that's my criticism almost all the time. And it's similar to the trope of using like the dumb kid trope, where it's like, I understand why you did it. However, could you have written the story in a different way to where you didn't need to go there at all?
Right.
And we could have gotten to the same place. And I think in this case, they probably could have, but I also think it probably doesn't matter. I don't know that we're going to see these characters again that are introduced in any like substantial way in the future. They weren't really introduced like they were going to be substantial fixtures in the future. They were kind of introduced like the same way Kim was, where they're like a character in passing, and like, yeah, they may come back, but it doesn't seem like they're going to play a pivotal role like Jod does, for example, moving forward.
You don't think that this skeleton crew is going to end like the second season of The Mandalorian, where they go around and collect up all the main characters to have one final showdown?
I think they actually might do that, but at least then they'd be part of like an ensemble.
Yeah.
Right. You know, there's a bunch of them in the background more so than like focusing on them. But yeah, like I really enjoyed like the bookends of this episode. I thought were great. The middle part, I was a little bit like, well, it's kind of some dark subject matter to be like handling in this childish way. But like a lot of the stuff that the characters do in the middle part would have annoyed me a lot more if it like wasn't kids doing it. Because it was kids doing it, I was kind of just like, oh, whatever, man, kids do stuff. You know, like there's a couple of scenes where like the girl does like really unnecessary flips that immediately reminded me of Book of Boba Fett, with like these super unnecessary like flips, like jumping off of something and flipping for no reason. And I was like, you know, when an adult does that, it's kind of lame. When a kid does it, it's like, nah, I can see a kid doing that. Like, kid wants to show off.
Yeah, I actually, in my head, I renamed that character Unnecessary Parkour Girl.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was silly, and it was entirely gratuitous, and I didn't mind it at all. Yeah. So anyways, here, like my overview of the way that this show played out was like some great plot movement at the beginning, some great plot movement at the end. And then Neil steals the show in the middle. And I was absolutely here for the whole thing. I think Neil is a fantastic character. Part of me feels like the way that like R2-D2 is the secret protagonist of like the original trilogy. Part of me feels like Neil is actually the secret protagonist of this entire show. And like while Wim and Fern may be like sort of taking charge and KB is out there solving problems left and right, I feel like Neil is the heart of the show and just a fantastic character. And I really appreciated seeing him get some time to shine.
I also really enjoyed Neil this episode. They've kind of taken this this tack where like KB felt like almost the main character last episode. Like she got some speaking lines with none of the other characters around, and that was how Neil was this episode. So I feel like they're trying to give all the kids like their time, you know, to shine in the spotlight,
yeah,
and give them a little episode that's like mostly just for them. So I enjoyed it as well.
They have kind of cycled through them, right? It was like it was all about Wim, and then it was all about Fern.
And so I don't know if they're going to do that because now we're four episodes in. So I don't know if they're going to hold that pattern for the last four episodes and do the same thing. But it's worked really well because you feel like you get to know each of the characters. But at the same time, they don't disregard the other characters. The other characters still get some good, you know, character development. In particular, Fern and Wim get some good character development
at the
tail end of this. And Jod continues to intrigue me, I think, as a character. You continue to not really... He's been around a bunch. He's said a bunch of words. You still don't really know anything about him or who he is, which I think is a fun place for that character to be. So we could probably just jump into the synopsis unless you got anything else to add here before we start.
No, I think let's jump right into the episode and we'll explore why this is actually a better episode than you think it is.
Okay. So I did that last week, I think. Oh, wait, that we should actually talk about.
Yeah.
Did you come around on Kim at all upon any rewatches? Did you soften on your analysis of her as a character?
I love that you're asking this question like you don't already know the answer to this question.
Well, the listeners don't know the answer.
They don't, unless they're in the Discord.
Yeah, that's true.
And then they do. So here's the facts. All right. So I decided to go ahead and, you know, give Kim another chance. And on the next rewatch, I rewatched with my daughter, and you know, we sat down, we made popcorn, we kind of did the whole thing that we usually do when we have a new episode of Star Wars. We made it, you know, a little bit of an event, you know, a bonding experience, and it was a much better experience. And what I found was that I did not mind Kim. I don't think it's like the best new alien design,
mm-hmm.
but it is what it is. And ultimately, after that, I have not felt like her character design distracted me from the rest of the show the way that it did the first time. So I don't know if it's just sort of like it was very jarring on the first go around. And then after that, well, I'd seen her before, and so it wasn't so jarring. Or if it was just the better mindset, some combination of all of these factors. But I am, you know, I do think I've gotten over it and Kim's all right. She was always a good character. I just, you know, it's just the character model that I think that really threw me for a loop.
Yeah.
I also learned that actually she is partially practical effects. There is actually a model that they built and like moved around with like puppeteers and wires and stuff, and then CGI'd over the top, which I did not know. I guess I had assumed that she was like some combination of like maybe a bit of mocap for like the face and then pretty much entirely CGI, but actually no, there was a significant amount of practical effect. And just knowing that also makes me more inclined to like her, which shows my old man biases.
I mean, Skeleton Crew is doing a good job of handling that. There's a great video that they have posted on their YouTube called Creatures and Droids, and it talks about their desire to do as much as they could with practical effects and with models and stuff. And I was talking to you before we started recording, and I was saying I think that is part of the reason why this show feels so Star Wars-y, despite almost entirely being based around stuff that we know nothing about in Star Wars.
Right.
Right. So despite the fact that almost everything is foreign to us, it feels so familiar, and it's because there's a very heavy reliance on practical effects, which I love. And then in addition to that, you know, I was complaining in episode 3 about the X-Wings and the way they were flying. And what I didn't have any complaints about was the Onyx Cinder and the way the Onyx Cinder was moving. And I was saying that I wish they had done models for the X-Wing. Well, it turns out they did models for the Onyx Cinder. So the Onyx Cinder is actually a model that they have built. It's a practical effect that they have on like rails moving, and then they CGI the background and like additional details on top of the Onyx Cinder model. And I think that's why the Onyx Cinder's movement to me feels a lot more like natural and correct and abiding by the laws of physics. And the X-Wings, which were unfortunately purely CGI'd, felt less so.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, I wish they had done that for the X-Wings too. And I know that, you know, it's probably extremely expensive to build practical models of those things that are good enough to be used in shots and to set up the rigging and everything. But man, it's just really, really funny to complain about that and then see ILM post on their Twitter a clip of how they do the stuff for the Onyx Cinder. And I looked back and I was like, you know what? I haven't had nearly the same complaint about the Onyx Cinder. That's pretty funny.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's interesting. I think that'll be something I'm going to try to remember to like kind of check on in the future. Is if you say nothing about the way a ship flies that we've seen like significant flight for, I'm going to be like, is this a practical effect then? Like, is that how we know? You have no instinctive like hate for it.
Yeah, I mean, could be. Also, it was funny.
You have a good
ILM,
eye for it, so
I reposted ILM's thing and I mentioned something about it and ILM liked the comment. And I was like, oh, look at that.
Oh, nice.
Whoever's running the ILM social media actually saw what it was that I wrote, which I thought was pretty cool. And yeah, I mean, speaking of flying, it's like I've got an eye for it because like I'm flying airplanes, you know, almost weekly at this point in time.
Right.
And so like I know the way they should look and do look. And even though that's not how it would look in space, that's the rules that they've established for the universe. You know, we talked about this before, but like, look, capital ships broadside each other in space. Is that actually the way it would work? No, of course not. Like, that's not the way they need to do it. But that's the way Star Wars has, you know, assessed that they have battles in space. And so abide by those rules, you know?
Exactly.
And if you do, everything fits in nicely. The same way using practical effects for creatures, stuff fits in nicely, right? When you lean too heavily into CGI, stuff starts to feel weird. Because that's not what Star Wars was based on. Star Wars was created in a time before CGI. And even when they got into CGI, they tried to abide by those same rules really, really heavily. Because they knew that if they didn't, things were going to feel weird, right? You know, you look at the prequels, and the prequels are almost entirely CGI because they had that technology then. But a lot of the stuff follows the exact same rules that the original series did. If you watch the way spaceships fly in the prequels, if you watch the way pod racers race in the prequels, if you watch the way the capital ships battle each other in the prequels, it all follows the same rules as the original trilogy. It's only really been since the sequels that I think they've gotten away from some of those rules.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's just, you know, turnover in terms of people who hold down the artistic vision or what it is. But it makes me really happy when I see something new come out that follows those same rules.
No, I have to agree. Absolutely. That is... The departure from some of the established way that things work in universe is probably like 70% of my problems with the sequel movies and why it was harder for me to enjoy them than a lot of the other Star Wars content that's come out. Even Star Wars content that arguably is lower quality in many other ways. If it sort of respects the established genre conventions that define Star Wars, then I can accept, you know, maybe lower quality writing, you know, or whatever, you know, like it becomes easier for it to at least feel like Star Wars, even if it's the objective production quality is lower.
So you're saying that if for the Holdo maneuver, they had lampshaded it with that slit they cut in the ship's shield to get in there. If there had been one shot of Holdo turning towards the ship and the person being like, they're powering up to jump to hyperspace. And the captain being like, who cares? She'll bounce off our shield like a fly. And then the person's like, sir, the shield is failing in sector 4. And then it shoots through and destroys the ship. You would have been totally fine with that, right?
I don't know that I would have, because the whole hyperspace ramming concept violates, it causes a lot of issues for Star Wars canon. I really think they just shouldn't have gone there. But
it looked so cool, though.
Look, she could have just accelerated and rammed the ship. They could have done the same shot without using hyperspace, and it still would have looked cool. That's all I'm saying. Is why create unnecessary problems for yourself? Why open the door to Star Wars fans picking apart the logic of your actions when you could just not do that and then have the exact same outcome you wanted, only nobody's complaining about it? That's all I'm saying.
And so now we have checked the box for complaining about the sequels in every episode, 139 episodes and counting.
The solution is, you know, the High Republic, and they explain about what happened, you know, what happens with hyperspace disasters and a little more about how hyperspace works.
So you're saying they had to build an entire new novel series.
Yes.
To explain the Holdo maneuver and why people can't just do it all the time.
Yep. That's the way that I have chosen to interpret it and justify it. Universes, you know, it's what I like to say. Holdo was a war criminal. Mm-hmm. That's the answer. Mm-hmm. And we'll just not worry too much about that.
All right, that's fair. So anyways, back to Skeleton Crew. I every single time it cracks me up to bring up the Holdo maneuver.
I know.
Just because one day we'll have to point people back to that episode, which is like an hour and 45 minute discussion of the Holdo maneuver and why it is something that you should not do, and how we had to justify it like as being something possible in the Star Wars universe, despite the fact that no one ever does it, you know.
Yeah.
Until the very end of the sequels, when you see a shot of someone having done it one more time.
Yeah. It is not a good thing to do. People should not do that. Like, that's where, like, you do cross the line, I think, from freedom fighter to terrorist is when you start doing that. Like, it's real bad.
Yeah.
That's neither here nor there.
The collateral damage could be catastrophic.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's see. The Onyx Cinder flies past a satellite. And this is the first clue, right? So they did not disguise the fact that this was not going to be Adaten.
Right.
Right. They were pretty obvious about it. The episode description says our heroes face a surprise in a familiar setting. So we kind of know that familiar setting probably means this is not Adaten. They pass a bunch of satellites. Like, there is a grid of satellites in the sky, but with, you know, some red glows around them. So that part is familiar to Adaten. And there are the nebula, like the green clouds surrounding it as well. So that part is familiar to Adaten. But I think even on first watch, you can kind of tell these satellites look a little like defunct or derelict, as opposed to in operation. They're not all perfectly lined up. Some of them have some like visible damage or degradation on them. And so even right away, we're kind of like,
I think it's pronounced
maybe not
derelict.
Derelict, yeah, you can. Derelict my balls, Mon Capitan, right? Yeah, good Zoolander stuff.
It is a really cool visual coming in, and it does very quickly, I think, convey that they have not reached the planet that they thought that they've reached, although it takes the kids a little longer to figure that out. And they do, again, leave just enough doubt in your mind. Think, well, maybe something awful has happened to Adaten since the last time we were there. Or maybe this is part of Adaten's disguise, is that it looks like a destroyed planet.
Or they landed somewhere different on Adaten that is destroyed.
Could be.
You know, there's no starships and everything is on rails. So you got to think they've only ever seen their city.
Yep.
And nothing else. The Onyx Cinder descends through the planet's atmosphere, and they do notice that there are some suburbs. They say, look, you know, there's houses, right? And they believe it to be their city, but the ship locks itself into an autopilot-like landing procedure that startles everyone except for SM-33. And all of their kind of complaints and chirping manage to convince SM-33 that he'll just take it out of autopilot and land it himself. I was interested to see where it was going to land if it continued taking them on their path.
Yeah.
And Jod even says something along the lines like, is this normal? Like, does anyone know if this is normal that it's doing this? And SM-33 is just like, whatever. Like, I think it's very, very funny that SM-33 doesn't, like, tell them the planet that they're on at all until, like, later in the thing. He just, like, lets the kids kind of run off on their own.
Right.
But they do land in a neighborhood, or at least the charred remains of a neighborhood. I love the visual of this, by the way. There's just something about like destroyed human settlements in a sci-fi narrative that just works wonders for me. So I really, really liked this whole like mystery of like, oh my God, what happened here? Why is this place destroyed?
More Fallout vibes for me in terms of setting.
Yeah.
Especially given the sort of the eerie dystopian vibes we've gotten from Adaten. to then be on a planet that looks exactly like Ad-Aten, except that it's an absolute ruin. Just, it really does give those sort of like end of the world dystopian vibes, just amplifies them. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, they exit the ship. Jod is like, is this Ad-Aten? Kind of reminds me of home, which clearly is not implied to be a good thing.
He says it tastes like ashy, what does he say? It tastes like ashy dust, is what he said.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. So they sort of, they head off in the, you know, into the distance. Neil sees something, and then Fern tells SM-33 to keep an eye on Jod and insists that Jod remain with the ship. And then SM-33 activates babysitting mode, which is hilarious. I can't help but wonder, like, does SM-33 actually have a babysitting mode, or is he just that sarcastic? Or is he just
very snarky? Yeah. I thought the same thing too. I was like,
I can't tell. They both feel believable. Or maybe it's both. But anyways, it's a very funny moment.
He says, come on, baby, back on the ship.
Yeah.
You know, baby, don't make me count.
Yeah.
And Jod's just like, I got to give credit to Jude Law for playing this character this way, because I feel like it would be so easy for a like pirate character to have it not feel believable that he's like taking orders from these kids. But he's like so jovial about it. And even though he's portrayed as kind of a nefarious character in the beginning, like it does seem pretty obvious that like he does care about the kids and he wants to help the kids out. And so he kind of like, when they're ordering him around, he kind of has like an exasperated, like, all right, whatever, you know, look to him instead of the like chafing under these kids bossing him around. He kind of more plays into it almost like, I don't know, like a babysitter would, or like a camp counselor would or something, where it's like, look, you know, your job is to make sure these kids are safe. And if they want to pretend like they're the captains and they're bossing you around, then, and they have a giant enforcer who could actually kill you in SM-33, then like, you know what? He kind of handles it jovially in a way that I thought was very fitting, and also a really hard balance to strike that I was impressed that he was able to do it.
Yeah. So the way I am reading the character is that he's very much playing him as sort of a, like, he prefers to solve his problems without violence whenever possible. Like, it seems clear that he is capable of violence. But he goes out of his way to avoid it whenever he can. And I think at worst, he sees the kids as still being useful. Like, that if he can get to Ad-Aten, that he sees like this can work out for everybody. And he would rather have it work out for everybody. And so while, you know, he could maybe be more villainous, it's just easier. The path of least resistance is for him to just play along and do what they say and be the helpful uncle, helpful if mischievous. And so it's how much of that is like he actually does want to be like helpful, and how much of it is like it's just easier not to argue. And I feel like that's probably a bit of the conflict of the character, is like, you know, he's obviously had a hard life and he's had to just kind of play into this role of manipulating people to get what he wants and to survive. And it ultimately ended up, you know, with him in prison on a pirate base. So it's not like it's really worked out that well for him long term. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think there probably is a hope that maybe things could be better, but he's also just kind of manipulative at base, because that's what he's been doing for his whole life. Yeah, I agree, though. Jude's playing him very well.
And he does go back with SM-33 and go back onto the ship. He's got his own things he'll deal with, but I think he looks around and pretty, you know, quickly comes to the realization that, like, well, maybe I'll just let the kids figure this one out. And, you know, he'll go do his own things on the ship. So the kids do head off. They find a ruined house. And the interesting thing about this house is that it's actually the same set that they used for Fern's house on Ad-Aten. So it's the exact same set physically, but it's been changed substantially to reflect what StarWars.com refers to as decades of damage. I thought it was interesting that they specifically used the term decades as opposed to centuries or years. So that kind of gives us some idea of when this stuff happened. But Neil correctly points out that whatever happened here had to have happened years ago because the tree that's in the house is of a certain size. If it had only happened recently, the tree would have been much smaller. And if it happened, you know, way longer ago, it would have been even bigger. So Wim has a very interesting idea, which I actually like that they lampshade this, which is like, what if we fell asleep for 100 years and we just came back and this is Ad-Ad? And Fern's like, no, dummy, like that's a story. That's not what happened. And like, that is a common trope of like someone leaves and comes back. I mean, God, Planet of the Apes did it, right?
Right.
Like, yeah. Where, oh, this is a different planet. Oh my God, no, it's the same planet 100 years in the future. And so I like that they kind of like acknowledge that trope and then disregard it. And they're like, no, this is clearly somewhere different.
Futurama, right?
Yeah, Futurama does it. Which I'm actually I'm watching the newest season of Futurama right now. It's still pretty good.
Nice.
You know, it's not, I wouldn't say it's as good as like the last season of Futurama was, where the ending, the finale was probably one of the best finales I've ever seen in my entire life. I think it's called Meanwhile, and it loops. If you've ever watched it, it loops perfectly with the first episode. So if you watch the last episode and then immediately watch the first episode, it's a perfect loop, which is like super cool. But I'm watching the new seasons that they've done on Hulu, and they're actually not bad. You know, it still has that same Futurama, you know, feel to it. And they still handle, you know, kind of topical events the same way Futurama did. So I've been enjoying
it.
Nice. But
I wanted to say, I found it really interesting that Neil comments about the size of the tree, because it's not necessarily implied that like Ad-Atten hasn't been around for a while. But it does make me sort of wonder, like, wait, how old do they think their society is on Ad-Atten? Like, how long do they think that they've been there? Like, why would the tree be so young? Like, is their city on Ad-Atten, like, basically brand new? Like, has it only been there for one generation? Why is the size of the tree telling them that it's been a long time? Is it just that they're comparing it to Fern's house and saying, well, if this was Fern's house, then the tree would not be this big?
Well, I think it's just that, like, if you have a tree growing in your house, right, and you only moved into your house, you know, 10 years ago or something, like, you're not going to have a very big tree.
Right. But I guess that makes me, that's what I'm asking. That's what I'm wondering, like, well, so are they saying that their settlement on Ad-Atten is actually pretty new, or at least not that old compared to this one?
Well, I think they're saying that most of the settlements on Ad-Atten don't have trees in them because, like, this one's missing the roof. And so, like, a seed got in and a tree grew. And so they're like, if the seed had only gotten in a year ago, the tree would have been pretty small.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was real confused by that.
Oh, we actually have a tree in the house normally.
I thought maybe they did. I was like, okay.
No. So if you look at some of the stills that they have online, you can see that there's a huge chunk of the roof missing. And I think the tree was just like a seed that blew in and the tree started growing in the house.
Okay.
And Neil's just pointing out, if this tree had just started growing, like, it'd be a lot smaller, but this tree's been growing for a long time. So clearly the destruction that destroyed the roof happened, okay, you know, decades ago.
Yeah. I was like, was there a shrubbery that went out of control? Like, what? I didn't follow that for some reason. I don't know what was going on in my brain at that point, but
no, that's what I'm here for, is to help line things up, right? So Neil, you know, obviously is the one that kind of points out that, like, this is almost certainly not Ad-Atten.
Right.
And KB also correctly points out, well, hold on, Kim said there was more than just Ad-Atten in terms of the lost jewels of the Old Republic. Maybe this is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, there's probably some people living here, which this is the only weird jump in logic to me. If I saw this stuff, I'd be like, everyone's dead. There's no one living here. But she's like, you know, anyone who lives here may be able to help us find Ad-Atten. Meanwhile, Wim picks up some like gross oil liquid that has drained into a thing and is like messing with it. And it's like, come on now, Wim. But, you know, he actually didn't bother me too much. I think someone in the Discord was pointing out that they felt that like Wim was being, you know, suicidally naive again. I actually didn't find too much of an issue with that. I thought the only thing that kind of bothered me at all was when they're by the Hatan patrol and he like sticks his head up in the window of the bus. And I'm like, bro, you have basically an afro. You are the most visible of all the children. Like, put your head down. Like, your hair is huge. But they at least kind of, they zoom out and it, you can tell it's really hard to see through that window. So I was like, all right, you know what? That's maybe fine. I appreciate them doing that. But meanwhile, Jod is doing what Jod thinks, and he's rummaging through the children's belongings on the ship. And there's a hologram, like a portable hologram of one of the characters from the Star Wars Christmas special, you know, dancing along with that music. And he also finds Wim's bag of Old Republic credits. And I want to point out that multiple times it has been referred to by characters in the show and both, you know, outside of the show, Old Republic, not High Republic, not Galactic Republic, Old Republic. So that leads me to believe that whenever they got cut off from society was before even the High Republic stuff that we got with the Acolyte. Is that, are you reading it the same way as I am? Because I feel like the distinction between the Old Republic and the High Republic is actually something that Star Wars has established in their own timeline.
So that's actually a great question. And the way that I understand it is that High Republic is more of a term for a period of time during the Old Republic, in which the Republic was sort of like at the height of its power and influence in the galaxy. That ran, you know, for, you know, a few hundred years, essentially, prior to the time of the Republic during the Skywalker saga films. And that it was essentially, the Republic was already in decline by the time the Skywalker saga takes place. But that it had existed for many millennia prior to that, and just maybe it hadn't been quite as large. It hadn't been as truly galactic until the time of the High Republic. And that's when it truly became like a galactic republic, although it may have called itself that at times prior to that. But yeah, so the way I understand it is that Old Republic, Republic, Galactic Republic, Grand Republic, High Republic, these are all the same political entity, just over a period of millennia. The term that might be used to refer to it might vary a little bit, and the size of the Republic varied over those centuries as well.
I think so. They have established that there is a different era between the two, though. So same Republic, but referred to as a different era. And the reason why they did this was actually very much like a real world reason, and it was because the High Republic was old enough to where they could have freedom to tell stories, but new enough to where they could still use some of the oldest characters that existed in the Skywalker saga, meaning like Yoda and stuff like that. So that was why they differentiated the High Republic as its own era in canon. And that was what it enabled them to do. It was like, so the High Republic is a more recent part of the Old Republic. So the Old Republic is characterized as there is no relation to any of the characters in like the core Skywalker saga. Like that's how old it is. And then the High Republic is that little window where there's still some relation, but it's only the oldest characters. And so the Acolyte exists in the High Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And then the thousands of years before that era, where there is literally no relation at all, would be classified as the Old Republic from a publishing perspective in terms of where they align their books.
Right. Like, so fundamentally, to kind of give like a really brief history lesson of like the Galactic Republic. The Galactic Republic was founded something like 25,000 years prior to the Skywalker saga taking place. And then there was like a Jedi Sith war that took place that destroyed most of the Galactic Republic and devastated much of the galaxy. And the Galactic Republic more or less fell apart. This is like the oldest of the Old Republic. Like when somebody says old, capital O, like they're probably referring to the time period prior to the Jedi Sith Wars. And then after the Jedi defeat the Sith and destroy the Sith Empire, the Republic reforms. And it's technically the same Republic, but it's, you know, sort of like rebuilding its influence in the galaxy. And So it sort of, you know, you might say this is like the Galactic Republic era, where it's sort of rebuilding itself. And then the High Republic is there. This new version of the Republic spreads out into the galaxy and brings the Outer Rim in and all of the other systems in. And then we're sort of caught up, you know.
Right.
And all of this takes place over a time span so vast as to be incomprehensible, which essentially leaves room for them to just tell whatever story they want. And they can just say, well, it was set during this rough time.
And as someone points out on IMDb, when we're looking at age in this show, one of the most telling things for age is the actual Onyx Cinder itself does not use repulsor lift technology to hover or to land. It actually turns its subspace engines down, or sublight engines down, and uses the thrust from those to land, which gives some indication of the age of the ship, because almost nothing, even in the, you know, even in the prequel era, almost nothing uses that technology, right? So that also gives some indication of how old the ship was and how long it's been buried and stuff like that, because everything else now just uses repulsor lifts, right?
Yeah.
And anti-grav lifts and stuff like that, so that they can hover and they don't have to direct thrust downwards, which is something that I hadn't actually thought about, but does make a lot of sense.
That is, yeah, that is a really interesting observation. I had also kind of taken note of it having such a distinct engine style, because, yeah, you're right, we never see that with Star Wars ships. That would make sense for it to be an extremely old design.
All right, let's see. So back to the show. Jod finds, you know, the bag of Old Republic credits. He inspects one of the credits and bites it, I guess, testing to make sure that it's, you know, real gold. But he's ambushed by SM-33, who doesn't recognize him and just mistakes him for a thief aboard the ship, which he kind of is, a thief aboard the ship.
Yeah.
You know, the droid pins him up to the bulkhead. Jod's like, it's me, it's Jod. And SM-33 apologizes and says, oh, man, being on Akron is playing tricks with me circuits. And Jod's like, excuse me? Did you say at Akron? And SM-33 is like, of course, this is a very dangerous place, you know. And he's like, what about at Atten? And the droid pauses, and this is the furthest he's ever gotten without saying it.
Yeah.
And says, you know, it does remind me of, and then he says, oh, can't say I remember no at Atten. And the little rat pops out of his eye, like right at the time. And apparently this rat is named Snowball, by the way. This has not been said in the show, but according to StarWars.com, the rat's name is in fact Snowball. And he is a favorite among the cast members.
Is Snowball secretly the true captain of the ship? We'll never know.
That would actually be an extremely funny twist. Maybe too funny of a twist. But it turns out the captain is Snowball, and Snowball is the one making sure that SM-33 never tells anyone about At-Atten. But I thought this was funny because, yeah, like, the rat pops out and he says, can't remember anything about At-Atten, and then there's like this like whirring of servos in his head, and then like a bunch of smoke comes like pouring out of his like body.
Yeah.
And he's like sitting there like twitching back and forth, and Jod's like, well, you know, why don't we see if we can jog your memory? And he walks him out of the ship. And then we switch back to the kids. The kids are kind of walking through the ruined streets. Wim, of course, is being Wim and is playing with a piece of wood that he's pretending is a lightsaber.
Mm-hmm.
They find a beheaded statue with an arm outstretched. And this is a delightful addition to the mystery, because you can tell it at least appears to be a humanoid male, but without the head, you know, you're like, is it Palpatine? Doesn't seem to be. It wouldn't be. He doesn't dress like that. Was it the supervisor of this planet? Like, who is it?
Right.
Who is this person that, you know, that the statue is of?
Well, it's King No Head.
Yeah, according to Wim, at least.
And I really enjoy the interactions between the kids right here, because it does feel very much like the kind of argument that kids might get into over the name of the statue, and like, you know, Fern kind of being disdainful. Do you really think that his name is King No Head? Like, she's like, stop goofing around. And, you know, Wim kind of is leaning into it now because he knows that it's annoying her. Right. And so it is just kind of a fun little moment, but they're quickly startled by some blaster shots. And they take cover only to find themselves flanked by two very small masked figures. I say very small, about the same size as the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And these figures want to know what flag they fly. And there's kind of a bit of back and forth as they're like, what are you talking about? And then the older of the two figures identifies them as Troik. And she takes off her helmet, revealing herself to be a human girl. And explains that they're fighting another faction that are called the Hatton. And they ask again, you know, like, what flag do you fly? Who are you? And Wim, a little excitedly, head in a storybook, asks, are you an army of children battling the adults for control of the planet? And for a moment, I worried that that would be the plot of the episode.
Yep.
But Neil steps in, says, oh, you know, I'm Neil. We just want to find our way home. And then they all take cover in a burned out tram with a little bit of gratuitous, but sort of amusing parkour. And they hide as a number of soldiers who I think they specifically identify as Hatton soldiers march past with a hover tank that some on the interweb have claimed resembles, I believe, a separatist hover tank, like a modified separatist hover tank.
Seems like it is, at least. I mean, it doesn't seem exactly like one of the hover tanks, but it does look familiar enough, and it's using repulsor lift technology,
right?
So it can't be that old. So it does seem close enough to where I thought the same thing. I was like, that looks almost like one of the Trade Federation tanks.
Could be. Yeah, it is, but it's if it is, it's disguised well enough to throw you off. They've also got some Eopes, which are an animal that we've seen previously on, what planet did we see them on? Tatooine.
We saw them on, in the Obi-Wan show. We saw them on Tatooine, and we saw them in The Phantom Menace. They're a slightly different species, though. They're not quite the same. They don't have the same, like, snout-like long nose. I think maybe they thought that'd be too similar to Neil, so these have horns instead.
Mm. Yes, horned Eopes. A distinct breed. So they, you know, the kids kind of watch as they as this force goes by, and the Troik girl says, you know, they'll kill us if they find us, and you know, we need to get out of here. And does a dramatic slide down the inside of the tram, and then leads them to a military base. I can't help but call out the unnecessary parkour when I see it.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. The slide I could almost justify because it's like, well, it kept her below the cover, right? And it was the fastest way to get from the top to the bottom.
Yeah.
Did she really need to get there that fast? Probably not. It saved like at most like 2 seconds. But, you know, the way I look at it is like, look, if an adult does this stuff, it's like kind of weird. But when a kid does it, it's like, you know, I've seen kids jump off of stuff and do flips all the time just because, like, they want to show off. Like, there's literally nothing more to it other than them wanting to show off.
Right.
And so, weirdly, for me, even though I found it very hard to believe Wim's suicidal, you know, naivety, I found it much easier to believe that this girl would just do this stuff because she just wanted to show off. And I was like, you know what? It is what it is. So, I agree with your title, your labeling of her as unnecessary parkour girl. But it didn't strike me as much as the unnecessary parkour in like Book of Boba Fett did, which like some of the times I literally like rolled my eyes watching it. I was like, come on now.
Yeah.
Like that's just totally not needed.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. For having a kid do it makes it work in a way that having an adult do it does not. Because that is, you know, kids like to do things in whatever like strikes them as the coolest way that they can do it. Right. Like I remember my daughter as a toddler, we would take her to this play place in a mall. And there's like this structure that the kids could climb up onto a couple of different ways. And then there's a slide for them to get down. And every single time she would walk up to the slide, look at me, grin, and then just jump the entire thing and land and just cackle madly and then run and do it again. Like, yeah, unnecessary parkour. Like there, yep. You literally could have slid down in the exact same amount of time, but it was cooler to jump it. And so that's what you did, you know? And like, that's not something kids necessarily lose. unless it's like enforced out of them. Anyways, moving right along, they head to a heavily damaged school building, which is identical to the kids' school, except that it's been through an apocalypse. And this is the Troik base, their headquarters, home, and military stronghold. And they take the crew to meet General Strix, leader of the Troik, and self-proclaimed true ruler of At Akron. I don't know about you, but I can't help thinking Akron, Ohio, every time I say this name.
I didn't think that, but now I'm almost certainly going to when they talk about that. But yeah, General, you know, Haina, which we learned the girl's name is Haina, by the way. Haina tells Strix, which is her father, the Hatan have stolen our herd of Eopes. And then the other little kid kind of introduces them. And he's like, they give us nothing but their worthless names.
Yeah.
And he says their names. And Fern says, Captain Fern, actually. And Strix is like, oh, Captain, so you are warriors. And Neil's like, no, we're kids. And they're like, shush, Neil, be quiet. And then Wim says, like, no, we're just children. But he says, well, on this planet, we treat our children as adults. And we help them to help themselves. And this was kind of like, this middle part from here until probably they reunite with Jod, I wasn't the biggest fan of, because like the child soldier thing to me plays a lot weirder in live action than it does in cartoons. And like the idea of treating like what looks to be a, I don't know, a 12 or 13 year old girl and like a 10 or 11 year old boy as like soldiers, and having them go out and run patrols and potentially get killed, just, I told you before the show, but it reminds me of Lord of War, which is an old Nicolas Cage movie about the arms trade, specifically in like Africa at one point, where they use child soldiers. And like, it's very, very dark.
Yeah.
Like super, super dark. And as soon as they started talking about this stuff, it like kind of, the parallel was drawn in my brain between those two things. And they kind of gloss over it a bit. Like, Neil acts as the voice of reason to them and talks to Haina about it. And is like, why are you guys fighting? You don't have to do this. Like, where we come from, we never fight. But the way they just, like, slide past this of, like, they have child soldiers on this planet was done, I think, very much from, like, a children's perspective of, like, oh, yeah, kids fight. And then, like, move on with the story. And for me as an adult, I was like, oh, man, that feels like some really, like a really dark addition to the story that if you're just going to like slide past it, I feel like you almost could have maybe done something like a tiny bit different and like taken away. And I think kids probably just don't even notice it at all and just like enjoy the story and move forward. But for me, it struck me a little bit weird how like cavalier they were about the whole thing. And I was just like, oh man, that's like, that's kind of a bit odd.
Yeah. So I think for the most part, especially younger kids, it's going to go right over their heads. Some older kids may sort of catch on a little bit. And it, obviously, like, this is, you know, a thing that has and does happen in the real world. It's horrifying. And it's a pretty dark direction for the story to go. And so I think because this is a kids show, you know, they handled it in the only way that they could. You know, essentially, you know, kind of giving it the Disney Mouse Gloves treatment, where it's like, you know, underneath the surface, there are claws here, but we're gonna put some nice white gloves over the top and just move on. While all of us know the truth, we're just not gonna get too deep into it because that's not the point of the story that we're trying to tell. But they do acknowledge the bleak nature of existence on At Akron. It almost makes me wonder if somebody out there had a really bad experience in Akron, Ohio, and this is their way of getting back. But anyways, I felt like this is one of those areas where they did some things where adults and kids take very different messages away from the story without either of them overlapping. So it's kind of kept light enough that kids are just, you know, exploring the world, seeing, you know, they're sort of having fun and then they're afraid. And for adults, we're sort of confronted with the dark reality of what's happening in the story. And I think I enjoyed that it was kind of an interesting contrast between the absolute naivete of these kids who are from a literal, like, paradise world where their lives are so completely structured and safe that the whole concept that they could be in mortal danger is alien to them. And the bleak reality that the kids on at Akron are faced with, which is having to fight for their lives. And I really appreciate that Neil is the character who comes forward at this point in the story, because he is the most empathetic by far. And yeah, I think, you know, while it was a dark direction to go, I do think that it was a way to let Neil shine and to say, you know, the other kids are all kind of caught up in their own things. You know, KB's caught up in being the best at doing everything. And Wim is caught up in the story, you know, and living out this adventure. And Fern is kind of caught up in trying to one-up Wim and trying to be the boss and to fill this role that she thinks she needs to fill of being in charge. And Neil's the only one who stops and is like, this is terrible, and I don't like this, and I feel really bad for the people who are in this situation. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the story of, like, what happens for, like, the next 15 minutes or whatever on screen, I feel like.